At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Moncrief on News Talk.
After World War II, the fledgling European Union was born, the basic idea being that international trade would benefit everyone on this continent and that countries that are economically interdependent are less likely to go to war with each other. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the US embraced a similar idea, which became known to what is today known as globalization. David J. Lynch is global economics correspondent for the Washington Post, and he argues that, at least in its current form, it's not working. He's the author of The World's Worst Bet, How the Globalization Gamble Went Wrong and What Would Make It Right. David, good afternoon.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Was there an architect of this idea within the US, or was it kind of a case of, well, this is the way the world is moving anyway and we might as well embrace it?
Well, a little of both, but I think of President Bill Clinton as sort of the godfather of U.S.-style globalization that emerged after the end of the Cold War. And I think Clinton, more than any other American politician, really understood what was happening, understood the stakes, and understood the potential dangers. And what he always said was, look, globalization is a fact, not a choice. This is because of technology and other things. This is the way the world's developing. The issue is we've got to make it work for all of our citizens. And he said there's going to be winners and losers. That's inevitable, but that's okay because the winners are going to do so well that they're going to be able to afford providing for the so-called losers, the folks in society with the least amount of education, the fewest skills, basic manufacturing workers. And that help, that provision of relocation, retraining, income support, you name it, that just never happened. And that was kind of the missing piece, and, you know, helps explain why we've ended up in the world that we're in today with so much domestic discontent in the U.S. of a sort that ultimately gave us President Donald Trump.
Why didn't it happen?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think number one, you know, there was always something else that took higher priority. So in the late 1990s under Clinton, we developed sort of a fetish for the balanced budget here in the U.S. So government programs, particularly after the Republicans took hold of Congress in 1994, new social spending programs were just a non-starter. Then in the Bush administration, we, you know, quickly ended up in the global war on terror. So you had wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. We wanted to keep China on side in some of those efforts, and certainly in dealing with a potential nuclear North Korea. So there was always some other higher priority. And I think part of it also was that economists in that time underestimated and just frankly got wrong the extent of the domestic dislocation that was going to happen. They based a lot of their analyses on the experience of trading between one advanced economy and another, so say the U.S. and the European Union. And in those kind of transactions, you don't see a lot of factory workers put out of work. But when suddenly you're taking on board an enormous undeveloped economy like China back in the 1990s, with just almost an unlimited low-cost factory labor supply, they should have seen coming what that was going to mean for the sort of the lowest-ranking workers here in the United States. That was a big problem.
Yeah, and was that calculation even then that there'd be lots of cheap goods coming in from China, which would benefit consumers in the United States? Now, the trade-off was that manufacturing jobs would be lost in the United States, and somehow that would be made up for by reskilling people.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. You know, my argument is not that globalization is a bad thing. I think globalization is a terrific thing. It certainly made my life better, and it has, as you suggest, benefited all households in the United States thanks to low cost Chinese goods. We saw an expansion of our purchasing power. The dollar literally went farther than it otherwise would have. So all of that was to the good, but we dropped the ball, frankly, on understanding how the integration of China was going to work. You know, we spent a lot of time in the late 90s at a time when American power was really at its zenith, no challenger on the global stage of any consequence. We spent a lot of time talking about and thinking about how global trade and global integration was going to change China. We didn't spend enough time thinking about how it was going to change us. And a lot of the estimates of the time were just wildly wrong. We had one study from the U.S. government in the late 90s that predicted when China joined the WTO that imports would only rise by a few percent, 5-10%. And in fact, in the space of 3 years, they went up by 50%. That's quite a difference.
Yeah. Also, I suppose one of the miscalculations was that it would change China, not just economically, but politically. And there wasn't even a trace of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I moved to China with my family about 6 months after China joined the WTO. And in those early days, and for the time I was based in Beijing, you could see the sort of change happening that was consistent with the theory you describe. In other words, I remember interviewing Chinese college students on the campus of Tsinghua University, one of China's great educational institutions, and none of them cared a whit about joining the Communist Party. They were all looking forward to, you know, getting out of school and starting a business or going to work for a private company and making money and living a better life, exactly what you would think would be consistent with that sort of, global prosperity. But, you know, within a few years, the momentum for economic reform in China began to ebb. Certainly by the time of the Beijing Olympics in 2008, the security services were reasserting control over political expression and the like. And so the rise of a more pluralistic China that we anticipated, and nobody expected China to become some sort of Jeffersonian democracy. Hmm. But we did expect them to sort of start moving down the path that a lot of the other East Asian countries had gone. Countries like South Korea and Taiwan that had been authoritarian, and then as they prospered and created a middle class, inevitably pressures for political change happened, and they became more democratic. We saw a little of that the first couple of years of the 21st century in China, but very quickly the hardliners reasserted control, and certainly under Xi Jinping since 2012, China's been going in a much more state-centric direction.
Yeah. Now, even if I mention the crash of 2008, people in this country feel a shiver down their spines.
Explain
the connection between that global crash and globalization. Did one cause the other?
Well, this is another part of the gamble that we got wrong, if you will. The idea of allowing global capital to move easily across borders all over the world, so money is kind of sloshing in and out of economies. And as you say, this is a key part of the Irish banking collapse in 2008-2009. And earlier, we saw this happen in the emerging markets in Asia in the late 90s, and then the Russian ruble crisis. But it wasn't just in emerging markets. The flip side of our trade deficits with countries like China was an enormous amount of capital coming into the United States. And in simplest terms, we had sort of two rivers of money coming from China and coming from European banks that ultimately helped. The good news was in those years, it made loans more available to American homeowners who wanted to get cheap mortgages. But the bad news was that ultimately fueled our housing bubble and made the bubble and the bust in 2008-2009 worse than it otherwise would have been.
Mm, and then it's kind of shivered all over the world. Is it?
Yes.
It's now, I won't get, and maybe this is simplistic, but it looks like what President Trump is trying to do is revert the United States back to a pre-globalization era. Is that possible? Can you put the genie back in the box now?
The short answer is no. And I think a lot of what President Trump has been trying with tariffs is trying to do with tariffs is fighting the last war. Efforts to sort of reconstitute a larger manufacturing workforce in this country are, if not doomed to fail, they're doomed to be incredibly expensive and inefficient. You know, we've seen, thanks mostly to automation, a decline in the number of manufacturing workers needed, not just in the United States, but also in advanced European economies. Even in China today, manufacturing workers as a share of the total employment are declining. And that's because, you know, thanks to automation, we can produce more with fewer people. We saw that in the farm economy 100 years ago. We saw it in manufacturing. It's, you know, part and parcel of progress. So trying to you know, get all these manufacturing jobs back to the United States, I think is really fighting the last battle. What we've got to worry about, what I say in the book, is, you know, if we want to be prepared for the challenges of the next 30 years, we've got to understand what we got wrong about the last 30 years, because the so-called China shock that we went through in the first decade of this century is not going to be the last time that American workers are challenged by a time of great upheaval and tumult. And certainly what we're already beginning to see with artificial intelligence is a sign of that.
Yeah. Also, the amount of money, of Chinese money, still in the American system, I assume it's not possible to really disentangle that now.
Well, China has been trimming over the past couple of years its holdings of treasury bonds. You know, Xi Jinping across the board is trying to make China more self-reliant and trying to reduce his exposure or his country's exposure to the U.S. But, you know, for folks who would want to say here in this country, oh, well, we should just sever ties with China, not do any trade with them, just sort of wall ourselves off, that's really impossible, because even despite everything now, we still have two-way trade with China of about $600 billion a year, which is quite sizable. That's down about 20% from a year ago, but it's not going to go to zero. And even if somehow you could wave a magic wand and make it go to zero, even in products that we buy from other countries, whether it's from Ireland or the rest of Europe or Latin America or Canada, many of those products come with significant amounts of Chinese content or material inside of them. So, you know, we're, as I say all the time, we and the Chinese are kind of stuck with each other. We're not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere. The challenge is to figure out a way for us to get along and coexist without the relationship tipping into open conflict.
Are there guardrails that could be put in?
Well, I think, you know, one of the guardrails that we've tried over the years is pretty basic, which is to make sure the senior leadership in both countries is talking to each other. And we, you know, we went through a period at the beginning of the Biden administration where that wasn't happening. And I should say the first Trump administration also came in quite skeptical of these ongoing dialogues and discussions. They thought it was basically the Chinese were using them not as a way to really build good faith ties, but as a way to just sort of, put us to sleep while they developed and just have endless talking shops that never really produced anything. But in fact, you know, it is important for officials in both capitals to know each other, to have some relationship so that when there is a crisis, and we saw this in 2008 with Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who had put a lot of effort into developing ties with the Chinese, not just when he was in the private sector at Goldman Sachs, but after taking over the China portfolio for George Bush in 2008, or 2006, I think, was when he joined the administration. You know, Paulson was able to get on the phone to the Chinese Central Bank at a time, a very dicey time in the history of that 2008 crisis, where the Chinese were considering dumping a lot of their holdings of U.S. Securities. And Paulson had a good enough relationship that he was able to get to the central bank governor of China, say, hey, this is not the time to be doing that. Things are not as bad as they look here in the United States. And he was able to talk the Chinese in off the ledge and really avoided making that situation a lot worse.
Yeah. Domestically within the United States, can anything be done in the short term for those communities that have been left, that have been genuinely left behind by globalization, that who, you know, once had well-paid jobs 10, 15 years ago, and now there, many of their communities have been hollowed out?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not possible to kind of undo what's been done or to go back, you know, because a lot of this damage was done now 20 years ago. And for better or worse, these communities or the people in them have moved on to other things. To me, what's important is to learn the lessons of this experience and say, okay, well, what did we get wrong? What other policies should we put in place for the next shock? And again, whether it's AI or the transition to a low-carbon economy or some, you know, crisis that we can't foresee at the moment, we need to worry about the policies today that we should have and start thinking about them, start experimenting with them, perhaps on the state level or on a more limited basis in at the national level. But do that today and not wait until we find ourselves in a crisis. And we do have some knowledge of what can be done. You know, we had expanded unemployment insurance, for instance, during the pandemic that was, was really quite effective in preserving the ability of households to continue spending at a time of great economic distress. And those programs lapsed with the end of the pandemic. But some of them might be the sort of thing that you put in place that are triggered automatically so that when unemployment starts to go up by, you know, say a meaningful percentage, 3-4%, right away those programs kick in so that you don't have to wait for political pressure to build, to go to Congress, to get a vote in the House, to get a vote in the Senate, to convince the president to come on board. All of that takes time, and it's time that individuals and families often don't have in the middle of a downdraft.
Yeah, that sounds like communism to me, David, but thanks so much for speaking with us today. That was David J. Lynch there, the author of The World's Worst Bet, How the Globalization Gamble Went Wrong and What Would Make It Right.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.